Let's see here. I would like to introduce our main speaker for tonight, Rod from San Diego.
Good evening. My name is Rod Mitchell. I am an alcoholic. Welcome to our visitors and welcome our newcomers. There's quite a few of them, I counted right. Wow, this is awesome. I haven't been able to do this in quite some time, and I'm very excited to be here. And I want to thank Felix for asking me to come down and speak and share with you guys tonight. And I want to thank Greg for your lead. That was awesome. I'm new to San Diego. I moved down here from Long Beach about a year and a half ago, so I'm still kind of a visitor. I'm getting my bearings on what's what and where's everything, and, you know, so far things are going good. Wow, this is really out of my comfort zone, but you know what? What I was told early on in sobriety is that you suit up, you show up, you know, you just do the next indicated thing, and that's what I'm here to do. My sobriety date is May 18th, 1991, and for that I'm very grateful. You know, life is very different in sobriety, and you'll hear more about that. What I want to talk about, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, as it's described in the big book. You know, we share in a general way. And for me, you know, I think I was an alcoholic when I came out of the chute. You know, I was born into your normal alcoholic family. Both my parents drank, and, you know, when I was very, very young, adolescence, all I remember was both parents arguing and fighting. That's all they could do. And, you know, for a long time, I didn't understand what was going on. And, you know, as I got older, all I could remember was that these two people, they don't like each other. You know, why are they together? You know, why did they decide to have another kid? I'm the youngest of three. I have a sister who's 13 years older than me, and my brother's 19 years older than me. So the way I look at it is, pretty simply, is that my parents went out one night. You know, they got it on, and 9 months later, I popped out. You know, so, oh well. So, you know, yeah, no doubt. So anyway, you know, from that point on, it was very interesting childhood for me because I didn't really have a strong upbringing with my parents because they were doing their own thing. And, you know, there was a lot of highs and lows, and a lot of the lows were, you know, trying to fit in. You know, I just didn't fit in, and I just don't remember ever fitting in when I was a kid. I grew up in Long Beach, as I mentioned, and my neighborhood consisted of a lot of older kids, probably 5 years my senior. And I tended to gravitate towards them because, one, they let me. And secondly, you know, they were cool. You know, they were the older kids. They had the cars. They had the girls. They had the drugs. They had, you know, everything I wanted. And I just hung out with, and I felt somewhat part of, and they were kind of my bigger brothers, if you will. They looked out for me because I was a very shy, very intimidated. You know, I stuttered. I had all the things that nervous kids have, and it was very hard for me to, you know, do what we're doing today. If you would have told me, you know, when I got sober, I'd be speaking in front of a bunch of people, I may have not gotten sober. You know, so anyway. The thing is that I've gotten past that for the most part. And, you know, growing up was just, you know, I just tried to do the best I could. And I was a full of rotten little brat. My father, you know, he did the best he could. You know, he came from Chicago, and his parents, my grandparents, were alcoholics. And back then, they didn't have AA. They were just locked up, and, you know, they threw the key away. And my father took a train out here to California and met my mother, and best I can recall is that my father was in the Navy and met my mother, and I guess they fell in love for whatever reason, and but they had my brother, and I guess my dad wasn't around for the first 5 years of my brother's life because he was in the Navy and going through Pearl Harbor and all that. Anyway, when they came out here to California, my dad started working for this company, John's Manville Roofing Company. And, you know, he was quite successful with that. And my mom was a stay-at-home mother. and she drank. That's all she did. She drank and drank, and when she wasn't drinking, she was bowling. And bowling is a very big part of my story. I was raised in a bowling alley, seriously. You know, when she wasn't, you know, housekeeping or, you know, making bills, whatever, that's what she did. She bowled. And the expectation was early on in my life that I would become a professional athlete. And unfortunately, things got in the way of that. You'll know why here shortly. What happened was, you know, I started hanging out with those older kids in my neighborhood, started doing what they did. You know, I didn't do well in school. School was boring to me. I didn't like it. You know, I didn't really understand. Lo and behold, third grade came around, and I was held back in third grade. Thus, my first resentment. Didn't know that at the time, but that was a major resentment, because one more time, you took me out of my, you know, comfort zone, and you put me back a grade, and all my friends are going on to the next grade, and no one could explain to me why. You know, anyway, so I did that gig, and by the time I was in sixth grade, I, you know, started being very, I don't know, violent, but I was being very aggressive, and I excelled in all my sports, especially football at that age, because I had a lot of anger, and the only way I knew how to displace that anger was on the football field. And so, even though I was a small kid, I had an ego, and I had an attitude, and I was pretty good, and I could use that, you know, to my benefit. And I just, you know, I had that anger motivating me, and you know, my coaches, they patted me on the back. Good job. Do that some more. And so I kept doing it. And when I was in sixth grade, since I was the oldest kid in sixth grade, because most kids were 1 year younger than me, I was more of a bully. And I stuck up for the younger kids or the less disadvantaged. You know, I that way today, I stick up for the disadvantaged people. I work in the field of doing that. Anyway, so as I was growing up, about age of 11 or 12, I was nipping at alcohol all the time, probably from 8 years on or 8 years old. My parents had their little liquor cabinet, and I would go in there and experiment. And when my sister had her friends over, I would put some concoctions together and say, here, try this and try that. And so anyway, I'm just flashing back on all that fun stuff. Amazing. Anyway, yeah, so, you know, my sister, she was very instrumental in my survival in that house for a long time, because she took me out. She would take me down to the beach and just let me hang out with her. And then she moved out, and then it was just me. And it got to be really problematic, because the fighting just continued and continued. And I tried to do everything I could to stay out of that house, because it was just not fun. And my dad never hit my mother that I know of, but my mother would run back into my bedroom, lock the door, and stay in there until my dad stopped doing what he was doing. The next morning I would get up, and there would be all these trophies broken out throughout the house. And it was, you know, not a nice thing to wake up to. But anyway, as I got older, I got into, and I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and drugs are part of my story, and I keep that very limited. I started smoking that non-addictive pot, and part of my neighborhood, they were very, very, what's the word I want to use? They were pretty high into that, and this one guy was a dealer, and I got to hang out with him. And, you know, again, one more time, I'm doing what these kids were doing, and school was not something I did. I only participated in school when there was some kind of a sporting event. And, you know, I came home one afternoon coming home from elementary school, and just to give you an idea of what it was like, a couple houses down from where I was living, there was a gang fight, not gang fights like today when they're just guns. These guys had chains and knives and stuff. My mother went over there to try to break it up. Like, what are you doing? Hello? You know, she was just crazy. And, you know, God bless her and everything. But, you know, I just became this really defiant kid. You know, I was spoiled. I was rotten. And I just, you know, I really didn't have any respect for anything. You know, I was defiant towards authority. And I just, you know, I got suspended. And I just, you know, I hung out with the type of kids that were like me. You know, we hung out, we got high, and, you know, I got into junior high school, and, you know, I got on the football team, and I was the first seventh grader to make it on the varsity team. So that was pretty cool. And unfortunately, during that time, this is back in the 70s, I was accused of starting a riot. And again, you know, this is what I do. I I'm very defiant, and I'm very angry and just, doing my own thing. And what happened was somebody stole my school ring out of my locker room, and I was in this thing called Junior Thetis. It was an off-school campus. And I said, we're going to have this meeting at 12 o'clock at the junior high school. Well, the authorities of the school thought that was going to be a riot. And anyway, there was all these cops and whatever. And I'm this quarterback on the football team, and they suspended me. And I was like, okay, how can this work? And I got back on the team, and everything worked out. And, you know, that was the pattern of my life for a long time to come. And, you know, I got into bowling, and I got into playing baseball, and I excelled at both. I thought for the longest time that I was going to be this professional athlete. Well, when I was bowling in leagues starting around 15 years old, people bought me liquor so I would drink and relax and be calm. And that worked really, really well. But being the alcoholic that I didn't know I was at the time, alcohol, because I was a hyper kid, alcohol is a depressant, and it slowed me down, made me relax, and I could bowl really well. There was this older gentleman, he told me one time, he goes, Rod, if you ever learn to get rid of your attitude, you'll be a great bowler someday. You know, he basically was telling me, if you grow up, you know, you might have a chance at this. And, you know, being an alcoholic growing up wasn't yet to come. That wasn't going to happen for quite some time. And so I kept bowling, I kept playing baseball, and, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, and I just couldn't believe how much ego I had coming into this deal. I was playing baseball, and my brother was our coach, and we had a couple years of really bad seasons where we, you know, we didn't win very many games. But the last season I played for my brother, we went undefeated and we won. And I was the starting pitcher and shortstop. Anyway, we were asked to play this church just out of, you know, fun. And I was sitting on the couch at home going, well, I don't want to go. I can't go. I don't want to. I'm going to stay home and watch TV. This doesn't mean anything to me. And so, you know, my parents said, no, you need to get up and go. And I just said, no, I'm not going. And so I didn't, you know. And I looked back at that, and I just went, wow, how selfish was I when I was growing up, you know, because I just didn't do what I was told to do. I just rebelled. And, you know, I did what we did. And, you know, fast forward into junior high, I went to school because, you know, that's what I was supposed to do. And because I was 1 year younger or older than most because of the being held back in third grade, I got my driver's license in ninth grade, at the end of ninth grade. And most kids didn't have a driver's license at that time. And I got to drive my parents' car around, and that was pretty popular. And so we used to go to this park down in Long Beach, and that was like the hub for people to go to who did what we did. You know, there was anything from, you know, pot to alcohol to you name it, it was there. And, you know, there was a lot of other fun stuff, actually. People played sports and frisbee and so on. But I went there all the time. You know, when I wasn't at school, that's where I was probably at. You know, if I wasn't there, I was probably at the beach. But, you know, that caught up to me eventually. You know, I was ditching all the time. And, you know, the school thing just wasn't, you know, something for me. I went to school to play sports, and I liked woodshop, too. Woodshop was kind of fun, and, you know, it stimulated me a little bit. You know, then I got into, you know, some other fun stuff that, you know, we don't really talk about here. And, you know, I pursued that for a while. And, you know, as a result of that, you know, this neighbor of mine, he was the neighborhood supplier of all these drugs. And, you know, sadly to say, he never got it. You know, he OD'd about 3 years ago. And, you know, I often think back about all the people I hung out with when I was younger, where they're at today, and why am I the only one that I know of that got sober, and where are all these other people at? Are they dead? Are they in jail? Where are they at? And it just blows me away that God, for whatever reason, picked me to get sober. And not that I'm special or anything, but, you know, it's just amazing to me that out of the group of people I hung out with, that I'm the only one that I know of that got sober. And I did everything that they did, and probably not as much as some others, and it just blows me away. So, while I was in high school, you know, I partaked in all that stuff, and I sold some of that stuff, and it was pretty profitable because I, again, was able to have access to it, and I got my share after I sold it. And the alcohol, for me, like Greg was talking about, when I drank alcohol, it took away all that shyness, all that anxiety, all that stuff to stop me from being the person I wanted to be. You know, I could go talk to girls, I could dance, I could do all that stuff that, you know, if you're an alcoholic my type, that I just couldn't do. The stuttering went away. You know, I was able to function. Like, wow, this is pretty cool. And, you know, bowling and drinking, if you understand that, that's what people who do bowling do. They drink, and that's what I did. I became a Long Beach Elk, and Elks, traditionally, that's all they do. They drink. And so when I was interviewed to become an Elk, they asked me, why do you want to be an Elk? And I said, well, one, I want to bowl and then drink. You know, that's a stupid question. So, you know, I became an Elk, and I began, yeah, what an accomplishment. Anyway, so I began bowling when I was 21 in this, it's an amateur tour, it's called the ABT, and I was bowling with the Elks, and I was going up and down California. I bowled here, and actually, I have a sad story about that. I had a 280Z at one point. It was my baby, and I came down here, and my drink at that time was Long Island iced teas. And again, people bought me drinks all the time. You know, they thought if we get Rod drunk, Rod won't bowl very well. Well, that was not necessary too, because like I mentioned before, when I drank, I got relaxed and I was able to bowl. But as it talks about in our big book, you know, I always missed that line. I always blew right past that line. And, you know, I could go from a nice 250 game down to 80. You know, I was like, wow, how does that happen? So the bottom line is I wasn't consistent. I was immature, I wasn't consistent, and I didn't really care. And, you know, my brother and I had our fallouts, and he has his issues and whatnot. But, you know, having a brother and a sister so much older than myself, I just didn't fit in with them. My brother has kids almost my age. My oldest niece is... I'm 48. She's 47 this December. And my other niece is 46, and my nephew is like 40. So, you know, it was weird growing up because my parents expected my brother to raise me in a sense. Because every time they went somewhere, they expected my brother to take me along because my dad couldn't get out of bed. But in his defense, I should say this. He did take me and my friends surfing all the time. No other parent stepped up to the plate. So kudos to him. But, you know, getting him out of bed was very challenging, very challenging. But, you know, he was hungover, and my dad's drink was Clooney Scotch. And, you know, and my mother's was Coors. And, you know, I drank anything he put in front of me. And I went through my different drinks. I went from Rusty Nail when I was younger, and then I got into White Russians, Black Russians, and I started playing a lot of softball, and, you know, softball, there's a lot of drinking, at least where I played, and, you know, we would go to the bar after each game, and, you know, pitchers after pitchers after pitchers, and, you know, so for the longest time, you know, every day was drinking. There wasn't too many days I can remember from the age 12 through, you know, like 21. There was a brief moment in my life when I turned 21 or 22 where I got into this health kick, because I was thinking, okay, you're this athlete, you should act as if. And so I quit smoking, I quit doing everything, and that lasted for about a minute. Seriously. And, you know, I got back into doing the same things. I hooked up with some other people, and I got involved in some of that white stuff and did that. I got into some relationships, and relationships for me were very challenging because, you know, if you're an alcoholic of my type, being selfish, self-centered, and egotistical, it's kind of hard to be in a healthy relationship because when you're thinking nothing about... When you're thinking just about yourself, it's kind of hard to be in that relationship then. So I wasn't very successful in that, and I had a very, very bad relationship with this young lady, and we were together for 3 years, and like you were saying, the last thing I ever wanted to turn out was to be like my parents. That's what I was. You know, what did we do? We argued, we fought, you know, just like my parents, and I just went, wow, this isn't good. So, you know, we ended up having our problems, and she wanted me to get married because my best friend, he was getting married to her best friend, and, you know, she just wanted to follow suit. And I'm saying, why would I want to get married? I don't like you very much. You know, and, you know, it was, again, you know, I was a very immature little you know, brat that was in this man's body acting as I was supposed to be, you know, an adult, and I wasn't. And, you know, I was trying to be in this relationship, and the good news is that, though, I'll save that for a minute, but, you know, I went on with doing my thing, and we ended up breaking up, and I had this epiphany, because I was dating somebody else, and she was dating somebody else, and I said, I don't want to see her anymore. I want to go back to my ex-girlfriend. And she didn't want to have anything to do with me, and so I went into this really deep depression. And there was this watering hole in Signal Hill that I used to go to, Uncle Bill's, and I drank there every day. I would get off work at 4:30, and I would shoot down the freeway to Uncle Bill's. And then whatever happened, happened, and, you know, the next thing I know, it'd be time to get up and go to work again. You know, blackouts, I remember having them, but I don't know that I had a lot of them. I know I drove, you know, and got to places I don't remember, but I can give you an example of that. I was coming home from that same place. I was in my 280Z, and I was going down this one street, and I was clocked at going 120, and I pulled up in my driveway, and I kind of waited there for some reason. Cops pulled up behind me, and I rolled my window down and looked up, and it was this guy I used to play football with. I went, "Dude, I know you." And he looked down, and he goes, "Yeah, I know you." And then he goes, "So how long you been a race car driver?" And I went, "Well, what are you talking about?" He goes, "Yeah, I clocked you going 120. Well, cool. And, you know, later on, that would be a problem because, you know, there was other times where I got pulled over. I got pulled over coming home from the bowling alley. I was lit. We'd get done bowling around 11:30, and I'd close down the bar. You know, 2 o'clock, they'd kick us out. You know, I'd been drinking since 5 o'clock, and it's already now 1 o'clock, and I'm just lit. You know, I'm driving home. The cops pull me over, you know, and I could speak really fast, like probably now. And, you know, I said, you know, I could do this perfect handstand for you and blah, blah, blah. And the cops said, "No, you don't need to do that." But, you know, he goes, "If I see you again, you're going to jail." I got out of it. You know, I talked my way out of it, and then I talked my way out of a couple of other times where when I got sober, I can't be an alcoholic. I don't have any DUIs. I don't have any repercussions from my drinking, you know, so I can't be alcoholic. But, you know, so the bowling thing continued, and my sister eventually became professional, actually. You know, she bowled for like 4 or 5 years professionally. And, you know, let me back up. When I was 19, and what I'm about to say isn't very... I'm not proud of it, but it is what it is. If you're an alcoholic of my type, you know, these things happen. And, it was on a Friday, and I was getting ready to go to Lake Elsinore to go do what we do, party. And Saturday morning, my dad woke me up and says, "I called the ambulance. Your mother is not feeling well." Went, "Okay. Wow, almost 8 o'clock." So the ambulance came. They took her away. She apparently had a heart attack. And I said, "She's going to be all right." This is what I think I said. And I said, "Okay, great." I took off, went to Lake Elsinore, and came home Sunday afternoon and walked into the house, and there was a room full of people. And I kind of looked around and went, "Whoa, what's up? Why are all these people in my house?" And then my sister said, "Oh, by the way, while you were gone, your mother passed away." I went, "Okay." And I took that information, ran into my bedroom, and started crying. And my sister came in, and she goes, "You know, people are going to think this is your fault." I'm like, "Okay, cool. I really think really this much of myself right now, and you're just really supporting that, so that's great." So, another resentment. And, you know, so when I quit crying, I got up, ran out of the house, and I went to the park to go do what I do. You know, I'm going to stuff those feelings down as far as I can, as best I can, because I don't want to feel that stuff. So, you know, for the longest time, I just thought to myself, did she really say what I think she said, or was I just, you know, imagining that? Well, I'll give you the answer to that in a little bit. So anyway, I was mentioning something about being here for bowling, and I had my 280Z, and, you know, I was drinking those iced teas, and I dropped off my girlfriend, and we smoked a joint, and I got almost home to Belmont Shores. Well, my best thinking said, I got to the stop sign, I stopped, and the cigarette fell out of my hand, and I went to bend over to pick it up, and somehow or another, my 280Z ended up on the side of the road, flipped on its side. Well, if you think about it, how could that happen going very slow? It wouldn't. So I either passed out, and I hit these little yellow poles that are there to keep you off the grass, hit that, and my car flipped over. Well, best thing I could do was pop my head outside the passenger door going, "Wow, this isn't so great." About 4 or 5 people pulled over. They helped me pull my car out, and I had to change the tire and got my car going again before the police got there. Again, another time where I didn't get in trouble for my drinking. But anyway, it cost my car. The 280Z was totaled, and that was my pet. And I was, anyway. So that was kind of how it was like for me. You know, just one thing after another. And I just, you know, if you would have told me I'd be getting sober at some point, I probably would have not did what I did, you know, back then. I did what I did, and drinking was so automatic in my life. You know, you hear a lot of speakers say that, and for me, it's true. I drank because I loved the effect of alcohol. Alcohol did for me, like we talked about, it did for me those things that nothing else could do. And my self-esteem, my self-worth was under the carpet. I hated myself. From that day when my sister told me that they being my family are going to blame me for my mother's death because of my behavior. You know, it had nothing to do with anything else, of course, but, you know, I didn't know that. And so, you know, I went on hating myself the next few years. And, you know, I probably acted that out in several different ways. And, you know, when I turned 27, that was just after this breakup with that one lady, I got a job in the aerospace business at McDonnell Douglas. And, you know, it was my first real job, and making pretty good money. And I excelled there. You know, I did really good. And I was working second shift. And being the athlete that I was, I've had to succumb to some surgeries. I used to be an extreme skier, and, you know, challenged me, I'll do it. And I used to jump slopes all the time. And after a while, my knee gave out, and I blew out my left knee, and then eventually blew out my right knee. And anyway, so I've had all these surgeries, and, you know, I remember after my first one in 87, you know, I went from falling down to saying, can you help me? I need to get to the bar. I need to drink, because, you know, I didn't want to feel the pain. And, you know, everything I did revolved around alcohol or some kind of substance. And, you know, in 87, when I started working for this company, I was introduced to something else that we don't speak about in this meeting, but it's in the form of a rock. And, yeah. And, you know, 1988 was the beginning of the end for me. You know, I didn't know that I was going to be, you know, doing what I was going to be doing, but I did that for the next 2.5 years. It started off slow, and it became my higher power. You know, if anybody in here can relate to that, I think you can. You know, I started doing that as often as I could, as much as I could, and, you know, it was what it was. And there was a lot of stuff that went on with me and that, and the best thing I could do was, you know, I already knew I had a little drinking problem, but I knew I had this other problem too. And my work decided that they needed to do this little intervention because of my attitude. And so they took me upstairs, and there was my boss and the union steward and some other people, HR, I think, and the team leaders. And I went in, I go, what's going on? They go, well, we think you have a problem. I said, what problem? They go, well, we don't like your attitude. I said, what's wrong with my attitude? And they explained what was wrong with my attitude. And I said, well, if you just leave me the F alone, no problem. So they didn't like that. They didn't like that answer. So they said, we're going to give you an option. And that option is to either go do something about your problem, or you're going to be fired. Okay. So for the next 2 weeks, I decided, like, And at the same time, I was dating this one lady, and she was as alcoholic as I was. And unfortunately for her, she had tried to get sober 6 times prior to that. And we were having relations. And one day I came home, and she wasn't doing so well. And I took her to the hospital. And she ended up passing away eventually. And she just didn't get it. And matter of fact, my boss's husband, he died of our disease. And that was the first time I've ever seen somebody die directly of our disease. You know, he had all the alcohol symptoms that someone would have. And, yeah, that was devastating. But anyway, they said, you need to do this. And I said, okay. 2 weeks went, and I went and got into this facility. I took my girlfriend to this facility, and they asked me, like they usually do you have a problem? I went, no, I don't have a problem. And so I figured it out. Like, okay, this sounds like a great idea. She's getting clean, so maybe I should probably go get clean, then we'll have this white little picket fence, and we'll be happy, and everybody will be good. But that didn't turn out that way. Like I said, she passed on, and, you know, I was dealing with this dilemma at work where I had to do something, and I decided, okay, I'm going to call my EAP, Employee Assistance Program, and they suggested I do this outpatient thing, and I did that. And at the time, I still didn't have a problem drinking yet. I knew I had a problem with something else, but the drinking, it wasn't a problem because, again, I'd never got in trouble for my drinking. And so I went through this outpatient thing, and as soon as I got out of it, it was from 6 to 10, Monday through Friday, I would shoot over the bar, and I'd shoot down my Jack Daniels. It's like, no problem. And I'd, you know, come back and go to work, and, you know, they tested me, and I came up negative, of course. Or dirty. And so they said, well, you need to hang out for 2 weeks and then decide if you really want to get sober. And I said, well, okay. So they said I should go to these meetings. And I went, what meetings? And they said, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I said, don't think so. So a week came and went, and I went to my EAP again, and I said, I think I need to go inpatient. So they put me on a plane to Minnesota, and I stayed there for 30 days. And that was in March of 91, or April, March, right around there. And you know, I did their little 30-day thing, and one more time, my best thinking, I got to the airport on the 30th day, called up my girlfriend, saying, hey, listen, I'm coming home, and, you know, she said, well, I got other things to do, and I went, no, you don't understand, we haven't seen each other for 30 days, and I kind of want to have some relations, and anyway, so when I got to the airport, I found out that my flight was delayed, and so I said, I want some coffee. What goes good with coffee? Kahlua. Kahlua and coffee sounds good. So I had a Kahlua and coffee. So I didn't even make it out of Minnesota without having a drink. And it didn't dawn on me that Kahlua was alcohol. So who, go figure, you know. So anyway, I got home, and, you know, life wasn't the same. Or it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I was still angry. I was still, you know, depressed. And I did what I had to do. And May 14th, 1991, I was in the back alleys of Long Beach going for that one more piece of the rock. And I was in this alley, and I walked through the gates, and four or five black men decided they wanted to talk to me, and the guy that approached me had a sweater on with a pouch, and I'm standing here like I am now, and he came up to me, approached me, pulled out the gun, and pistol whipped me, and I went down on my knees, and I was begging for my life, and, you know, talking about incomprehensible demoralization, that's pretty low. And so I kind of figured out, like, you know, Rod, this lifestyle of yours isn't really going to be, you know, longevity here. You know, you're not doing so well. And so I was then living with my sister, and she gave me an ultimatum, you know, after the work ultimatum. And, you know, if you don't get back clean, you're going to be living somewhere else. And that somewhere else would have been my car. And at that time, my car was running very poorly, and the work thing was going poorly. The girlfriend thing wasn't happening. So I'm just going, yeah, life isn't so great right now. And so I was hitting a bottom that I never thought I would hit. And so when I got to this, I was seeing this psychologist, and they said, well, you need to go into this hospital. I just went into a hospital 30 days or a month and a half ago. And so the insurance decided they would pay for another 7 days. And so I went, okay. I went into this little hospital, and I did their seven-day thing. And you know, the first thing the psychologist, they do is intake, and the first thing the psychologist said, he goes, you don't like yourself very much, do you? Like, yeah, so, you know, and I was like, okay, that's no revelation. And so I did their seven-day thing, and they let me out on my birthday, which is May 24th, 6 days after my sobriety date, which is the 18th. And there was two entities in control of my life. There was the first treatment facility and this new one. So I was a puppet on a string. They were saying, well, he needs to go here. You need to go there. I'm going, hey, hi, can I say something? And they said, no, your best thinking got you here. And I'm like, yeah, you got a point. So anyway, you know, I took a suggestion for the first time probably in life, and they said, you need to move into this men's recovery home. I went, you're what? And they said, a men's recovery home. So I went, okay. And so I went and checked it out. Didn't like it because, you know, I had to share a room with three other guys, and I had to, you know, like, have relations with people. I was like, I don't want to do this. Well, I was so devastated, so, you know, I hit the bottom, and I was just, like, willing to do anything to stay sober this time. And, You know, if you said jump, I jumped. I did what you told me to do. And, you know, I moved into this men's sobriety home, and I said, okay, I'll stay for 30 days. And then 30 days came. I said, I'll stay for another 30 days. Well, that ended up being 14 months. And within that 14 months, you know, I started learning some things about me. You're like, wow, you know, you need to do these steps. And as a result of these steps, you might learn something about yourself. And what I learned was that I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life is unmanageable, that, you know, whatever I do, I have no control over. And I just went and did an inventory. I was at work one Sunday, and I did my first step. And I started crying. And I went, wow, it's true. I am totally powerless over alcohol. My life really sucks. And so I went on and did step two and, you know, three, and got down on my knees with my sponsor, and we did the third step prayer. And the fourth step, you know, I got into the fourth step. And when I got into the fourth step, when I was really young, like 5 years old, my neighbors, one of the kids, they did some, well, that was my lesson when I was 5 years old. So I took that secret and held it for the next 27 years because I wasn't about to tell my father and I wasn't about to tell my brother. I wasn't going to tell anybody. So that secret was going to go with me to the grave. Well, when I did the fourth step, that popped up. And a few other things, but that was one of the most important ones. That was the first time I told anybody about that. And when I told this guy about what happened, you know, because I wasn't sure about my sexuality, like, am I gay? Am I not gay? You know, so he said, no, that's okay. It's normal for kids to experiment like that. And I was like, okay, if you say so. So, yeah. So, you know, that was a major relief for me. And then, you know, the thing about what my sister said, you know, eventually, I went back to school because during that 10 or 12 year I had at the aerospace company, I got laid off three different times. So in 1993, I got into bodybuilding and I got into exercise and I started back in school. I went to junior college, Long Beach City, and, you know, bowling was paying for it. And I got called back. I would go part-time, full-time. Well, fast forward, I ended up getting two A's and a certificate. And the certificate opened the door for me to go to Long Beach State, which is where I got my bachelor's degree in social work. And that was in 2002 or 2003. And before I finish with that, you know, during all this time, you know, I got into this AA. I jumped in with both feet. You know, I started sponsoring people. I took commitments. My first convention, if I'm not mistaken, was here in 1991. I was convention junkie for the first 2 years. You know, I got into CA and I did AA and I just went anywhere I could. And I fell in love with this program. You know, that's what kept me coming back because I loved the fellowship of this program. The commitments got me out of myself. The service has just been what I've done throughout my sobriety. And the good thing about that recovery home, you know, it taught me how to interact with people, believe that or not. You know, and I would like to report to you that all those guys that I got sober with are still sober today. No, not. Maybe four or five of us are. You know, I'm 17 and a half years sober, and, you know, there's maybe, like I said, three or four people. But what I got to do in sobriety, though, I got to get back this life, you know, that I was throwing away. And, you know, the professional bowling thing, yeah, I got back into bowling, but it wasn't like it was before. Because everybody remembered me as this bowler, this really good bowler. And I said, I don't want to be that person anymore. I just want to be able to go out and bowl and have fun and just enjoy it for a change, not this pressure. So I got out of that, and like I said, I started back in school. And between going to school, I don't say this to brag, but in my first 90 days, I went to close to 200 meetings. You know, just I went to meetings because I was scared. I was that close to dying, and I didn't want to die. So I did whatever you guys told me to do, and I just followed suit, you know. And for 17 and a half years, that's been working for me, you know. You know, if you're not an alcoholic of my type, you know, I had to go make amends to a lot of people. One was my mother. I went to her grave. You know, that was really awkward, and I did what my sponsor said. Write a note. Say it out loud, you know, own up to your part. I did that. And I, you know, I did what I had to do with that. Fortunately, I got to be sober for 4.5 years of my father's life. He passed away in 1997, or New Year's Eve, 1997. I got to make an amends to that man, you know, and I found out, like, wow, he had a really, really tough childhood growing up. You know, he didn't have any parents. His sister raised him best she could, you know, so my dad did the best he could. The way he showed me his love was by spoiling me, you know, right or wrong, it doesn't matter. You know, that's the way he knew how to show love. And, you know, I got to, you know, see him in his last year. That was awesome, because had I not gotten sober, I would have not gotten to see that. You know, I would have not gotten to see my dad, you know, in his last days. And I got to clean up my side of the story, or my side of the street with him. Unlike my brother. My brother said something to me that stuck pretty good. He said to me at his oldest daughter's first wedding that, you know, it's your fault that our mother's not here to see my daughter get married. I said, well, thanks for sharing that with me, you know. So I was getting all this negative stuff all the time, you know. Not that you're a good kid or you're a good brother or whatever, but, you know, and sadly enough, you know, he has not chosen to participate in my life. You know, it's just, he, you know, I'll see him and we'll do the hi, how are you thing. And, you know, I've made my whatever amends I needed to make to him. And, you know, it's sad. It really is. I went to my very first baseball game at Long Beach State, you know, thinking, wow, that should be me out there. And my brother should be here with me checking this out. You know, who knows, that may happen someday, but the baseball thing's not going to happen. So, you know, I made my amends, and, you know, I finally felt some relief because, you know, working those steps for me has really made a difference, because it's not so much about working the steps, it's about what you do after you work the steps. You know, I've had to learn how to use the principles behind those steps. You know, so in all my relations today, I try to practice these principles in my relationships. So if I'm being dishonest or untrustworthy or whatever, I have to check myself. Because, you know, being a selfish person that I am, you know, I have to really look at my part in everything I do. And to finish up with the school thing, I went on to get a master's in social work. And I've gotten a job. What brought me to San Diego was my now job, which is working for the Department of Rehabilitation as a vocational rehab counselor. So I get to work with a lot of us, in addition to a lot of people with psychiatric problems and just, you know, just people disabled looking to find work. And, you know, that in itself brings me a lot of pleasure, just being able to be of service. And that's all because of this program. You know, had I not and got hit over the head with that gun that day and decided, like, you know, this is up, man. You need to get your act together or, you know, you're not going to make it. And, you know, like today, you don't even have to look at somebody and they blow your head off. You know, this guy chose to hit me over the head with the butt of the gun. You know, so, you know, I didn't know at the time. That was my first spiritual experience, you know. Yeah, like, wow, yeah, seriously. And, you know, before I close, I got a few minutes left, you know, you know, I got to talk about God, because without God, I wouldn't be here today. I have a relationship with a God of my understanding that I never had known before. When I was young, they tried throwing me into church. They tried making me go to church. And I went, you know what? I don't want this. This is nothing. I don't want to be here. And I rebelled against that. And I did go to this little church thing that the school had just to get out of school. You know, so I told you, I just didn't like school. I would do anything I could to get out of school in school. So I did that just to appease them. And, you know, here I am, 48 years old, and I have this God of my understanding, and I, you know, I hit my knees every morning and night. Thank God for another day of sobriety. Thank you for what you've given me, and thank you for what you haven't given me. You know, I am definitely not perfect. I still have my days, and just recently when I met Felix, I was at a convention down here in San Diego at the Town and Country, and I was at that convention, and I had my road bike on the back of my car, and it looked like somebody tried stealing it. Well, on the way home, it fell off the rack, and, you know, if you're an alcoholic like me, I beat myself up really, really well. Well, $568 later, it got fixed, and so on and so forth. But this last Sunday, I was riding that same bike, and my medallion that I've had for 17 years, it had my mother's wedding, a diamond from my mother's wedding bag on, the band on there, it fell off somewhere, and I don't know where it's at. It devastated me this whole week, because that's been a part of me for 17 years. You know, it's just, I know it's just a piece of metal, but a pretty important piece of metal. And so, you know, I've been kind of bummed about that. And also in sobriety, I've learned a little bit about myself. I have ADHD, and it's more ADD these days. And, you know, I'm doing the things I need to do
to be the best employee I can be because, I got the credentials, I got the education, but when my ADD rears its ugly head, it becomes very problematic for not just myself, but my boss, my clerical, you know, because they have to do my work twice, and that gets old after a while. So, speaking with some of my support group, you know, I decided to go check out this group. It's for people who have ADHD, and I go to this meeting now, and what I'm learning is how to become better organized, you know, and for me, it's just all relevant. You know, I do the things I need to do to stay sober on a daily basis, and I go to meetings. I try to be of service the best I can when I can, and I just try to apply these principles in all my affairs, and I just try to keep on the beam as best I can. You know, like I said, this week's been a challenge, but you know what? I haven't had a drink yet, and you know, I can't promise anybody that I'll be sober tomorrow or the next day. I can just tell you that, you know, if I wake up tomorrow, again, it's if I wake up tomorrow, you know, I'm going to do what I do, and hopefully I'll get to stay sober. And, you know, this has been a great meeting, and, you know, I really want to thank Felix for asking me to come on down, and I really enjoyed myself, and thank you guys for having me.